through zones of unquestioned regime control, rolling through checkpoints that parted for the Russians and did not close back up until the SAA truck at the rear of the procession passed. Court remained vigilant every second of the way, by keeping his eyes on the sectors Saunders instructed him to cover, but also by listening in to radio traffic. Saunders had a handheld radio tuned to the convoy's channel, but most of the transmissions were between the SAA units, in Arabic, and Court only picked up words here and there. Still, he figured he would be able to tell from the tone of the other men speaking if someone saw real danger ahead. Court spoke reasonably good Russian, though he didn't want Saunders to know. He hoped the Russians would be the first to spot any trouble, because that way, he knew he'd have more of a heads-up and better intel about any threat. He found himself surprised by the quality of the highway they rolled along, even out here in the sticks of Syria. It was as good as most he'd seen in the United States, and although the traffic was extremely light, the vehicles that were on the road were making good speed. Saunders wasn't a chatty man, but neither was Court, so for the first hour barely any words were exchanged between the pair. Court just rolled with the silence, establishing his cover legend as a grizzled and stoic mercenary. But eventually he decided he needed to mine this guy for any information he could get about what he could expect after they made it down to the Desert Hawk's base, and he wanted to feel the man out to see about options for getting off base once he got there. While still eyeing the roadside, farmland, rural buildings, and the distant hills, Court said,
"I've been working in Southeast Asia, mostly."
"Heard me ask, did you?"
"No. That's right. You didn't."
"I was just mentioning it to say I don't know much about what's going on around here."
"You'll learn. Everybody learns. Or else you die."
"Wouldn't mind avoiding the or else. Anything you can tell me that might help?"
"You were hired to train the Hawks. I wasn't hired to train you."
"I know we're training Desert Hawks, but I also heard we're deploying with them." Saunders glanced across the cab of the pickup at Court for an instant, then looked back to the windshield.
"Where'd you hear that?"
"From Lars Klossner himself." Saunders shrugged now.
"Almost every bleeding night they send us out with Desert Hawks Special Forces units."
"To do what, exactly?"
"No-knock raids, arrests, and good old-fashioned hits."
"In Damascus?"
"Sometimes, sometimes not."
He looked at Court again.
"Does it matter?"
"No. Just curious." Court pressed his luck. "Who's the oppo?" Saunders repeated himself.
"Does it matter?"
"Only to avoid blue on blue." Court couldn't let on that he had misgivings about targeting certain opposition groups in this conflict, but he needed information about just what, in fact, the Hawks had the KWA men involved with. When Saunders didn't respond to this, Court turned to the man.
"Look, I'll be a hell of a lot better at this if I get some kind of sit rep on what we're dealing with. You might even persuade me to watch your back in the process."
"I didn't ask you to watch my back."
"No, but would it hurt?"
Saunders looked like he'd rather just sit and drive, to be alone with his thoughts. But after a moment, he sighed.
"Blimey. All right, just to shut you up, I'll give you a 2-minute lesson on who's who around here."
"That would be helpful.
But keep scanning your sector. If you get killed before we get to Damascus, I will have just wasted my breath."
"Copy that."
The Brit rolled down the window and spit, then rolled it back up.
"All right, school's in session. First, let's talk about our side, the regime and its loyalist supporters. Russia's here in country. They are the patrons to the regime, helping to prop it up. But Russia hates most of the militias fighting for Azam, especially the Sunni militias, especially the Desert Hawks Brigade. They think the Hawks are too big and too powerful now, so they figure it's just a matter of time before the Hawks turn their guns around and start fighting the regime itself. Russia has a stake in Azam. They are here in country by his order, and they have him by the bollocks. So any potential threat to him is seen as a threat to Russian interests here."
"Makes sense."
"Most of the Christians here support Azam, because even though he's Alawi, which is a Shiite tribe, he belongs to a minority and runs a secular government. He doesn't persecute other religious minorities as long as they support him. If the Sunni jihadists took over, it would be bad for the Christians, just like what's happened everywhere else the jihadists took over. The Christians might not love the Alawites, but they know that without them in power, they're fucked.
Got it.
It's short-sighted, of course. Azam will kill Christians the same as he'll kill anyone else if they so much as complain about the weather. But that's the way it is.
Right.
The Russians do like the Syrian Arab Army, Azam's regular troops, and they work with the Desert Hawks from time to time, but there isn't any love between the groups. Then you've got your foreign Shiites. Hezbollah's fighting here, blokes from Lebanon, and they support Azam, but they stick to themselves. Ditto Iran. They have battalions of fighters here, and they use Russian air in their attacks, but they don't fight alongside the Syrian Arab army or the Sunni militias like the Hawks.
Why are the Shiites fighting for Azam?
Because he's an Alawi, which is a Shia sect. Iran knows Shias are outnumbered in the Middle East by Sunnis, so even though Azam isn't much of a Shiite, he's closer to them than any other national leader around here, so they help him out. It helps that the Iranians are in bed with the Russians, too. But that might all change soon.
What do you mean?
There's rumors floating about that Azam is trying to get Iran to expand into Syria in a permanent presence. The Russians won't take kindly to that, since they are trying to use the nation as their Middle Eastern outpost. So if Iran moves in and stakes a claim to bases and territory, the three-way love fest of the past 4 years will turn into a right bloody mess.
This tracked with what Court had learned from Voland about Azam sneaking into Tehran to negotiate with the Supreme Leader. Saunders adjusted his rear view as he drove. The convoy was rising into some steeper hills now, and the British mercenary seemed to tighten up his focus on his surroundings. Court turned away from his lesson and began scanning the thick pines on the hills on his side of the highway. Saunders continued.
So, that's the friendly forces. Now on to the rebels and terrorists. The rebels are 10 times more fractured than the loyalists, which is the only reason the regime is still around. You have the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, but really it's just dozens of groups and clans, most of which aren't anything like an army, and many of which aren't even remotely free. Then there's ISIS, who used to be just in the east and north, but now they're in little pockets around Damascus too. And there's al-Nusra, that's al-Qaeda. They're in the north mostly, but tend to pop up wherever you don't want them. They've been active around here, too.
Court just muttered. Jesus.
The Americans are way up north and way out east fighting ISIS, which is good. But they are supporting the Kurds, which is not good.
And what about the Kurds?
Yeah, they are up north, mostly fighting ISIS, but also the Azam regime. And they also have their own section carved out of the country. And when you talk about the Kurds, you have to split them up into tribes, factions, political groups, and the like. They aren't just one entity, either. The Kurds fight in the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a group of Kurds, Sunnis, Assyrians, and Turkmen.
And the foreign mercs? Us. Does anybody like us?
Saunders looked at Court and laughed.
That's a good one, Wade. Yeah. All the militias like their own foreign contractors, but nobody likes anybody else's. The Desert Hawks like us, because we train their special operations forces, and they use us to help fight their little denied battles.
Like these raids you mentioned.
The convoy raced past a row of slower-moving cars also heading southeast. Court and Saunders looked over each vehicle as it passed. Saunders said,
The Hawks have a particular beef with a Syrian army unit called the Tiger Forces.
What kind of beef?
Regular old mob shite. Remember, they aren't fighting a war down here.
Court furrowed his eyebrows.
They're not?
No, it's a gang fight. The Hawks are run by a criminal overboss, and so are the Tigers. They fight over oil smuggling routes. They get into it over turf wars. In a country as mad as this, with 25 groups trying to kill one another, the Desert Ox Brigade still finds time to pick fights with the would-be allies. It's bloody mad.
Court knew all he could do was pray he would be able to get the hell out of his cover identity and on with his real job. Otherwise, he might get himself killed in some arcane Syrian mafia turf war that he didn't even understand. Before Court could speak, Saunders leaned over the wheel and looked through the windshield intently.
Have you noticed any buses on the highway in the past couple of miles?
Court cocked his head. Buses? I don't remember seeing any. Why?
Bus drivers are the best intelligence agents on the highway. They know what's going on. If you see buses, you know the road is considered safe enough. If you don't see buses...
Saunders began scanning his mirrors.
Well, you tighten up your chin strap and flip off your safety.
Saunders looked back to Court.
I don't see buses.
It was true. Court realized he'd seen small sedans and hatchbacks, plus a few commercial trucks, but he didn't remember passing a bus in the past several minutes. Just then, a large white tractor trailer approached in the opposite lane. The vehicle was on Saunders' side, so Court wasn't focused on it. He was in the process of checking his rifle again when the radio came alive with animated Arabic. Court turned back around, understanding from the tone of the transmissions that something was going on. Saunders said,
Look at the lorry.
Court did so. The big vehicle was riddled with bullet holes. It had clearly been attacked up the road, and even though it had managed to survive, it was heavily damaged.
Eyes open wide. We're heading into it.
After an order was given over the radio, first in Russian and then in Arabic, all the vehicles in the convoy began racing faster along the road, including Saunders' pickup. Court thought it to be a wise move to accelerate through any potential kill zone. The enemy would be dug into fighting positions that they had chosen, whereas Court and the others in the convoy had no choice in the matter. And if fighting came, they would be fighting at a distinct disadvantage. Court looked through the windshield to the Desert Hawk's technical just ahead. The gunner stood behind his belt-fed machine gun, and he pulled the charging handle back on the weapon to rack around. He began swiveling the barrel left and right, ready for a fight. Court jammed his own rifle barrel outside the open window of his vehicle and aimed it on the terrain to the south. The high rolling hills were completely covered in green trees and shrubs. Court couldn't see a man-made structure in any direction. It seemed like the right place for an ambush, and all he could do was hope that whatever force was waiting up there in the trees would take one look at the line of Russians, Syrian soldiers, militiamen, and machine guns, and decide to hold their fire till some helpless vehicle passed. The convoy had to slow for a turn and cross a 20-foot-long bridge that went over a small drainage culvert, and Court's hope that the attackers passed on his convoy died when puffs of dust pocked the highway ahead of the Desert Hawk's technical. An instant later, he heard the unmistakable cracks and zings of incoming rifle fire.
Contact left!
Saunders shouted, and he one-handed his bullpup rifle out of the driver's side window and began squeezing off rounds with his right hand, while he controlled the steering wheel with his left. Court had no targets on his right, but he told himself he would fire if he saw anyone armed. Yes, there could be FSA men up there shooting at him, but he wasn't just going to sit back and let them kill him. Court was firmly engaged on the side of the bad guys now. He'd feel bad about it later, but for the moment, he was going to concentrate on survival. Just then, an explosion on the highway 50 yards ahead of the pickup sent a fireball into the sky. An instant later, the Russian gas truck that was second in the convoy slammed on its brakes. The next Russian truck locked its brakes as well, and behind it, the Syrian Mukhabarat Land Rover swerved to try to avoid the stopped vehicles in front of it. The Land Rover slammed into the rear of the Russian gas. Saunders shouted out a curse as he slowed, steering his pickup to the left, into the opposite lane, to avoid hitting the scrum himself. Court could see what had happened now. A massive IED had been placed in the drainage culvert under the highway and detonated just in front of the first Syrian vehicle. It appeared that the explosion had gone off just a couple seconds too early, so the lead vehicle had avoided outright destruction, and it had also avoided crashing down into the crater. But now the Syrian Zil truck lay on its left side to the left of the crater, and it blocked the westbound lane. There was no room to continue on the road to the east because of the massive crater and the debris around it. The only way forward was to leave the highway and slowly move over brush, down through the sloped drainage ditch and up on the other side. Court knew this would take a minute at least, and attempting this while under fire from the hills would be madness if there was any other option. Syrian soldiers who had survived the rollover began crawling out of the downed truck, and small bits of rock, dirt, and highway asphalt rained down on Court's pickup. Saunders yelled into the radio,
Reverse! Reverse!
Court's head was on a swivel now. He didn't believe the objective of the attackers had been only to fire a few rounds, take out the lead vehicle with an explosive, and then melt away. No. Knocking out the front of the convoy was the enemy's way of trying to block or slow the others in the convoy so they could be picked off. Court leaned out his window and waved frantically to the Syrian truck behind him, trying to motion them back so the surviving vehicles could all egress out of the kill zone to the west. But to his horror, he saw that the truck had stopped, and the occupants were dismounting.
"They're bailing!"
he shouted to Saunders. By now, gunfire was outgoing as well as incoming. The men in the Russian trucks and in the Desert Hawk technicals were firing at faint puffs of smoke on the hillside to both the north and south. A voice came over the walkie-talkie in Arabic, and Saunders said,
"The tail vehicle is disabled! Fuck it! I'm going around them!"
Saunders tried to back around the Syrians jumping from the damaged truck. But as he accelerated in reverse, machine gun fire raked the hood of his white pickup. The noise in the cab where Court sat was cataclysmic. Heavy clunks of lead traveling well above the sound barrier tore through the hood and engine. Oil, radiator fluid, and steam sprayed the windshield. The pickup jolted to a halt. Saunders ground the gears for just a second before shouting,
"It's dead! Bail out!"
Chapter 30. Court Gentry opened his door, fell out onto the highway, and then hustled in a low crouch with his rifle in his hand to the back of the pickup. Here, he knelt behind the right rear tire for a moment, just long enough to wait for Saunders to join him. The Brit might not have been any kind of real ally, but in this fight, Saunders was Court's battle buddy, and both men knew that they needed each other in order to increase their chances of survival. In battle, Court played second fiddle to no one, but he had the presence of mind to maintain his cover. He was a merc in the field working with a more senior employee of his company, so he'd operate as the second man in a two-man team. Saunders appeared at the back of the truck. Then he peered over it to the east, scanning the hills to both the north and the south. He shouted over the ungodly fire,
"We've got shooters on both sides of the highway!"
Court popped his own head over the concealment of the truck bed. He saw gun smoke in the trees to both the north and the south, and most of the fire seemed to be at least 40 yards to the east of where he knelt. Off to his right, he noticed a small rocky depression just off the highway, almost hidden because it was overgrown with weeds. He looked back at the puffs of smoke.
"They're set up wrong. The ambush is centered on where the IED went off, so it's still to our east. If we can get in this runoff ditch on the south side, we might find a little cover from both hillsides."
Saunders couldn't see what Court was talking about from his position at the opposite end of the tailgate, but he apparently didn't have any other options near him.
"Go!"
Saunders ordered, and Court took off across the wide open highway, across the shoulder, and towards the low brush and grass. All the while, the roar of gunfire continued in all directions. He covered 50 feet of open ground, a few bullet strikes tore through the asphalt and dirt around him, and then he dropped and rolled onto his chest in low brush and rocks, in the slight depression by the side of the road. Stones cut into his knees and forearms as he slammed into the ground. Here, he shouldered his rifle again, scanned the hill above him, and called out to Saunders, still at the truck.
"Move!"
Court kept his cheek tight on the stock of his AK, searching for targets through the old iron sights. Saunders tumbled on top of him a few seconds later, rolled into a prone firing position, then immediately began scanning up the hill right next to Court. Court looked back to the highway now. The Desert Hawks were still on their technical, but no one was on the machine gun, and one of the four militiamen hung halfway out of the truck bed, behind the weapon. In front of the Desert Hawks technical, the sedan with the Mukhabarat officers was burning and smoking, smashed against the back of the second Russian vehicle. The first Russian truck had turned around on the highway and was in the process of moving back to the west, but the driver seemed to be waiting for orders before taking off. Court was glad they were still around, because the half-dozen soldiers in the open back were all firing their weapons up towards the wooded hills. But there still seemed to be more fire coming in than going out. From the bullet strikes on the highway, Court estimated that more than a dozen weapons were raking the convoy from high ground. Saunders rose and fired a burst up the hill, more to Court's right and less to the east.
"They're trying to flank us to the south,"
he said as his weapon emptied. Court himself saw movement in the trees almost directly in line with their position, and he knew they'd be exposed here in the gully once the enemy repositioned on the hill above them. He realized the entire convoy was in danger of being wiped out, himself included.
and back to the west, from the direction the small loyalist cavalcade had come from, civilian cars began rolling up the highway, unaware of the gun battle happening around the turn. Some tried to reverse out of danger, and others tried to race on past the fight, a disastrous decision because through the smoke and chaos, the civilian drivers found that the road was blocked by a blown-out bridge. As Court watched, two civilian vehicles slammed on their brakes at the IED crater and got caught behind the indecisive Russian soldier behind the wheel of the GAZ. Court scanned back up to the southeast and saw his first enemy now, as the smoke trail from an RPG revealed a man 100 yards up the hill. He lined up his rifle's front post on the bearded man, who immediately began reloading the weapon. Court shot the man through the chest, with absolutely no consideration as to what side of the civil war he fought on. Three Syrians from the truck that had been disabled just behind the white pickup made a run for the gully where the two mercenaries lay. They ran too close together, and they left no one behind to cover for them. Court saw their mistake when they were almost to the shoulder of the highway, and he shouted to Saunders, "Covering fire!" Court sent bursts from his AK to the northern hillside, while next to him, Saunders emptied a magazine into the trees on the southern hillside. When Court's weapon emptied, he reloaded with blinding speed, using his fresh magazine to flip out the spent mag before snapping the fresh mag into the magazine well. While he did this, he looked back to the Syrian soldiers in the road. None of the three had made it into the gully. One lay dead on the shoulder. A second rolled around wounded in the tall grasses by the highway, lying in plain view of all the shooters on the hill. And the third man had turned around and run back to the poor cover of the unarmored Syrian Zill truck in the center of the road. When Saunders stopped firing to reload, Court could hear that he'd taken his handheld radio with him, because excited Arabic transmissions crackled from inside a pocket in the British mercenary's load-bearing vest. As Court dumped rounds into the trees at puffs of smoke, the shouting through the radio switched from Arabic to Russian. Court translated the broadcasts for Saunders.
"Two enemy technicals inbound from the east."
Saunders looked over to Court.
"You speak Russian?"
Normally he wouldn't have let on about the languages he spoke while adopting a cover legend, but there was no denying this.
"Just enough to know to pull my head down."
Saunders leveled his weapon on the north side of the hill and fired off a short burst.
"Well, I bloody well knew that without an interpreter."
A torrent of rifle fire tore up brush just a few feet from where Court and Saunders lay.
"Shit!"
Court said, firing at a flash deep in the trees to the southeast. Men in Arabic spoke over the net now. Saunders was occupied with a target, but Court asked,
"Anyone saying who these assholes are?"
So far, none of the Russians had identified the adversary over the radio. Saunders fired again.
"Nobody around here gives a toss but you, Wade!"
Court squinted into the distance through the smoke to the east, and he could just make out the approaching pickup trucks now. They weren't on the highway, but moving along thick brush on the steep hillside just below the tree line. They advanced on the wrecked convoy at a reckless clip. To his horror, Court saw what looked like two long and fat barrels protruding from the beds of each of them, larger and thicker than the barrel of a machine gun. He had a feeling he knew what he was looking at. To Saunders, he said,
ZU-23s on those technicals!
Bloody hell,
Saunders muttered, and then he scanned to the east with his scoped rifle to confirm. The ZU-23 was a 23mm Russian twin-barreled anti-aircraft cannon, but many insurgent groups around the world mounted them on technicals to make an extremely powerful and effective weapon that could be used for both air and ground targets. A couple of hits from a ZU-23 into a heavy truck could easily destroy it and all inside. Saunders confirmed Court's suspicion. He used the three-power scope on his rifle for a better view, ignoring supersonic rounds that cracked over his head and struck the rocks just feet behind him while he looked. He ducked back down to relative cover.
"You're right. We have to take those out before they rip us all to shreds."
The trucks were still some 600 yards distant, a long shot with a rifle, but this was all but point-blank range for the ZU-23. The gunfire all around was unreal. It seemed that all the other regime forces in the fight were engaging individual fighters on the northern and southern hills, and even though a Russian had been the one to call out the approaching technicals, the fire was too heavy at closer distances for anyone to be able to take the time to engage the new threats effectively. But Court had enough cover to pick his targets, so he rose to his knees again, aimed the simple blade sight of his weapon,
and tried to get a bead on the operator sitting behind the closest gun. Through the smoke in the air from the rockets and the massive IED that had gone off a minute and a half earlier, and aiming at such a small target picture that was on the move, it was an impossible shot.
I can't get the gunners from here.
Saunders spun to engage something up the hill to the south. His rifle fired 3 fully automatic bursts. Court remained focused on the pickups. He shifted his aim to the windshield of the closest one. The vehicle moved in and out of thick brush now, so he could only see it an instant at a time. He gave up and re-sighted on the gun and the gunner behind it. Saunders sprayed another long volley of automatic fire on Court's right, but Court maintained his concentration. He squeezed off a single round, and it pinged off the firing mechanism of the ZU-23. His round showered the weapon with a spray of sparks, inches from the gunner's head. Saunders stopped firing and tracked over with his rifle just as Court fired again. Again, Court hit the anti-aircraft gun within inches of the operator.
Bloody close,
Saunders said, and then,
Right, take mine.
He unslung his weapon, knowing the enhanced optic would give Court a better chance of making a shot that Saunders himself knew he had no chance of making. Court traded rifles, didn't even bother slinging the SA-80, and lined up the holographic red dot above the tiny exposed spot at the top of the ZU-23 operator's head. With a 3-power scope, the operator's head was still one hell of a difficult target. Court fired around, and the man tumbled backwards out of the pickup. He's down, Court said calmly.
Fuck me!
Saunders shouted over the gunfire of the battle.
Shoot the other one!
Just then, the second ZU-23 opened up. The twin cannons each flashed 2 times, and almost instantly the crashing sounds of cannon fire and shell impacts made it to Court and Saunders' position. 4 shells exploded right in front of the first Russian truck, sending fragments through the vehicle and knocking men down all over the length of the convoy. Court fired at the second gunner, missed, then fired once more. This time, he hit the man in the neck, spinning him from his seat, but he also drew an ungodly amount of fire from several directions. The entire weedy and rocky area in front of and behind him and Saunders began kicking up as bullets struck, so the two of them flattened in the depression next to each other. The men made eye contact while they lay there, inches away from the line of fire. Saunders shouted over the noise.
I told you!
He laughed maniacally, and handed Court a fresh magazine for his rifle.
We're gonna burn through all our ammo!
Freak, Court thought. Saunders reloaded the AK from a magazine he pulled off Court's vest, then held the weapon up over the side of the ditch and fired the entire 30 rounds blindly up the hill. Court reached up himself with the SA-80, held it over the side of the depression in the direction of a cluster of distant attackers he'd spotted just as he'd dropped, and fired the entire magazine in short bursts. He lowered the weapon and turned to Saunders to grab more ammo, and he was just reaching to the man's load-bearing vest to pull out a magazine when he saw movement close in the ditch, just 50 feet away. 2 figures stepped through the trees and onto the rocks higher on the hill. They wore black beards, carried wire-stocked Kalashnikovs, and approached the highway cautiously with their guns raised. Court could tell they were trying to flank whoever had managed to find a fighting position down here, and the only reason they hadn't pinpointed his and Saunders' location was that both he and Saunders had flattened lower and paused in their firing to reload. Court knew he'd be spotted in a second, so his hand let go of the magazine on his battle buddy's chest and slid down to the HK pistol holstered on Saunders' belt. Court drew the weapon as he shot forward on his knees, flinging himself on top of Saunders to use him as a firing platform. He extended the pistol out in front of him as both gunmen ahead reacted to the movement, swinging their rifles in his direction. Court opened fire. 2 quick shots at the first man, 2 at the second, 2 more at the first, and another at the second. Both men crumpled as they fell back into the trees, ending up one on top of the other. Neither of the 2 managed to squeeze off a single round from their AKs. Saunders looked back over his right shoulder just in time to see the 2 men disappear in the brush as they fell. The Brit said nothing. He just finished his reload, rose up a bit, and opened fire up the hillside. The sound of one of the ZU-23s firing another 4-round burst told both men a new gunner had taken position behind one of the big weapons, and Court dropped the pistol and reloaded the SA-80 quickly with one of Saunders's magazines, ready to try another long shot. But just then, he heard a new sound through the persistent gunfire. Saunders heard it too.
Helo, inbound!
One of ours? Cort asked.
This is Russian and Syrian airspace. The rebels and the jihadists don't have any air.
He pulled his rifle away from Cort, handed the AK back, and pointed to a spot in the sky to the west. There, a Russian Mi-28 attack helicopter bore down on the highway from 1,500 feet away. Almost as soon as Cort noticed the aircraft, black streaks emanated from its pylons, racing towards the site of the ambush.
Get down!
Cort shouted, but Saunders was firing up the hill again and did not hear. Cort reached out and grabbed the man by his body armor, then pulled him down flat in the gully, just as rockets streaked over the two men. The Russian rockets exploded well clear of the depression, midway between Cort's position and the technical. The Hilo fired again, and this time, Cort could hear explosions farther to the east. When the Mi-28 passed low overhead, Cort climbed back up to his knees. Even without the scope of the SA-80, he could see that both technicals were scattered and burning along the southern hillside. As every surviving member of the convoy sprayed rifle fire up onto the hills, the Russian helicopter circled above, using its machine gun and rocket pods to destroy enemy targets of opportunity. Minutes later, an Arabic speaker on the radio called a ceasefire, and the order was repeated in Russian. Cort and Saunders loaded fresh magazines into their weapons, then rolled onto their backs, exhausted by the effort and adrenaline flow of the previous 10 minutes. Saunders reached out a bloody gloved hand.
Cheers, mate. Good shooting.
Got lucky. Cort shook Saunders' hand, and he saw the blood.
You're hit. Nah.
The Brit lifted his arm to show it to the man he knew as Wade.
Cut me elbow on the rocks. It's nothing.
It was bleeding from shallow scrapes. His t-shirt was torn at the shoulder as well. He kept looking Cort's way.
Done a lot of this sort of thing, have you?
Once or twice, Cort said as he climbed laboriously to his feet.
Southeast Asia, did you say? Can't say I've seen much in the news in the past 50 years that looks this intense coming from bloody Southeast Asia. And you don't look like you were even a sparkle in your daddy's eye back in the Tet Offensive.
Cort knew his cover was being challenged. He just said, I've been other places too. He left it there, and Saunders did not pursue, but Cort could feel the man's eyes on him behind his dark sunglasses. To change the subject, Cort added, for the record, I didn't use all my AK ammo. Saunders sniffed.
We aren't even halfway to Babala, are we?
The man had a point.
No, we're not, Cort added. That was a large attack, but they did a lot wrong, which is the only reason we're alive. I'll take a bit of good luck, though. God knows I've had my share of bad.
As they walked back to the truck, the Englishman said,
And since you were so bloody curious about it, I can tell you who we were fighting. The only force around here that's got technicals with ZU-23s on them is Jabhat al-Nusra,
the local branch of AQ.
That's right.
Cort made no outward reaction, but a weight was lifted off him knowing he hadn't just flown into Syria and killed a group of democratic forces fighting against Ahmed Azam. Minutes after the firefight, 5 Syrian Arab Army 2-ton trucks, carrying some 40 infantrymen in all, rolled slowly through the traffic jam of civilian vehicles, then made their way between the broken vehicles and scattered bodies to take up security positions. The dead and wounded were attended to, and Saunders was told equipment trucks were on the way to move the wrecked vehicles to create a path in the brush to bypass the massive hole in the highway. The wreckage of the convoy was horrific. Vehicles smoking and burning, bodies and blood everywhere. Thousands of spent shell casings and dozens of empty magazines lying on broken asphalt. The wounded moaned, and the men shouted orders to keep eyes on the hills in case the attackers decided to brave the helicopters circling overhead and return for more. 3 of the 4 Desert Hawks soldiers survived, although one of the survivors had taken an AK round through the hand. Cort himself expertly bandaged the man's wound, and he helped the other 2 Hawks load their injured comrade, as well as the dead one, into the back of the SAA truck. 2 of the Russians had died in the fighting, and 5 more were wounded, including the platoon's medic.
3 Syrian Arab army soldiers were dead, with 6 more injured. 6 dead, 12 wounded. But Court knew that number could have been a hell of a lot higher. While Court was bandaging an 18-year-old Syrian private's shredded but intact leg, word got around the area about the Western security contractor who shot both ZU-23 gunners, possibly saving the lives of everyone in the convoy. The 3 Mukhabarat men, who all managed to survive unscathed by finding a ditch to hide in on the north side of the highway, all came over to shake Court's hand. Men that Court would gain great pleasure from killing in other circumstances smiled at him, tried to give him cigarettes, and patted him on the back. Court found it surreal. Chapter 31. Sebastian Drexler had spent the day traveling, and while doing so, he did everything in his power to keep from touching anything with his new fingertips. In this endeavor, he had been mostly successful. He'd touched little other than his mobile phone and his luggage while leaving Syria on his 4-hour chartered flight to Moscow. In the bathroom of the aircraft, he'd donned gloves to gently handle the zipper of his slacks. Russia was the easiest way into Europe from Damascus, so he chose that route. He found it unfortunate that he had to fly hours out of his way to get to France, but sanctions against Syria meant only certain nations were allowing airline transport into and out of the Middle Eastern nation. In Moscow's Sheremetyevo airport, he went through a VIP line for customs and immigration, out into the arrivals hall, and then he immediately walked over to departures and checked in for his flight to Paris. He took care to keep his new fingerprints as shielded as possible, even when hurrying through the airport to board his 3:10 p.m. Air France flight to Charles de Gaulle. In the first-class cabin, he drank vodka on the rocks, carefully holding the drink away from his fingertips. But he declined anything to eat, knowing that the most important part of his return to Western Europe was fast approaching, and the less he did that involved his hands, the better. His flight landed at 6:15 in the evening. He was one of the first passengers to arrive at the immigration kiosks, and here he slid his passport across the desk to the official with a tired smile. He was asked to put his fingers on the reader, and he did so carefully, making certain to place them straight down so none of the glued areas would be recorded. The immigration officer looked at the clean-shaven Drexler, then at the bearded man on the Finnish passport of Veti Takala, and he made a little face, but he did not react with any noticeable suspicion. Then he looked over to his screen, presumably to make sure the fingerprints matched.
"How long will you be staying in France?" the officer asked. "3 days, then a train home to Helsinki."
The sound of the stamping of Takala's passport almost filled Drexler with ecstasy. He was home. Or at least, close enough for now. Sebastian Drexler had told Malik he'd contact him the second he arrived in Paris, but his plane had landed 45 minutes earlier, and he'd yet to make that call. Instead, he sat in a plush living room in a suite at the Hilton Hotel Paris Charles de Gaulle, smoothing out the wrinkles of his navy Tom Ford sharkskin suit. A cup of coffee sat in front of him, but he ignored it, and instead concentrated on what he was about to say. The door to the suite's small dining room opened, and an attractive blonde in a business suit stepped out. Drexler detected an Austrian accent in her German.
"The principals will see you now, Herr Drexler."
"Vielen Dank."
He stood and stepped by the woman on his way through the door. There were 4 sitting at the table, all stern-faced men. He made the rounds with officious handshakes, though he worried that his borrowed fingertips might be damaged with all the touching. But after the greetings, he realized he needn't have worried. He found these 4 to be in possession of the weak handshakes of weak men. He knew all these men by name, although he just thought of them as the bankers. They were with Meyer Privatbank, Drexler's employer, and they had flown in to Paris Charles de Gaulle on this Saturday evening at his request. It was not a small thing to summon the directors of one of Switzerland's oldest and most secretive banks to travel some 600 kilometers for a meeting. And as Drexler sat down at the mirror-polished table, he couldn't help but revel in the thought that he commanded that level of respect from these men. The revelry faded as he thought about it. No,
He didn't command their respect. She did. These men were here because of Shakira Azam. They thought of Drexler as a necessary evil, a cutout between her dirty money and their sanitized perfect lives in Switzerland. The man at the head of the table was 40-year-old Stefan Meyer, the great-grandson of Aldous Meyer, the bank's founder. Stefan was vice president, behind his older brother Rolf in the company and familial pecking order, but he was the only Meyer who ever got his hands remotely dirty, which meant he was the only family member involved with the institution Drexler had ever met. Meyer said,
"We know you are here on an important assignment for our client in Damascus. Is everything on track with that?"
Drexler assumed Meyer didn't want to know any details about the work he was here to do. The vice president would only know that Shakira had demanded he fulfill an obligation to her, and if he completed the obligation to her satisfaction, she would reward the bank with more deposits and more business. If he failed to do the work, she could pull her accounts from the bank. Drexler said,
"I expect to have the job completed this evening."
"Excellent," Meyer replied. "I know our client is rewarding you handsomely for going above and beyond your duties to her accounts, and our client's husband has been pleased with your work in maintaining his foreign interests as well."
"I'm gratified to hear that,"
Stefan Meyer said.
"The bank is more than satisfied with your work."
The words coming from the vice president were flattering, but none of the four men across the table were smiling. Drexler knew they were all here waiting for the other shoe to drop, to learn why their agent in Syria had demanded a meeting with them right in the middle of an operation.
"Enough of the bullshit," Drexler thought.
He'd just tell them.
"I asked you all here because I would like to request immediate reassignment."
In the silence that ensued, he scanned all four faces. There was no surprise, no alarm, no discernible emotion. Drexler continued.
"I've spent over 2 years in Syria. I've done everything asked of me. It's time for me to move on."
"I don't understand," Meyer said. "We positioned you in Syria because it was the safest place for you due to your legal troubles. I am certain Interpol hasn't lost interest in you in 2 years, and there aren't many locales like Syria that offer both freedom of movement for you and a crucial business need for us."
"Syria has simply become too dangerous an environment for me."
"Hogwash," said Ian Pleasance, a thick-jowled English director of bank operations. "The civil war is being won by the regime, and won handily. ISIS is on its last legs, ditto the Kurds and the FSA. Russia will protect Azam, and by extension it will protect you."
Drexler acknowledged Pleasance with a nod, but said,
"I am not worried about ISIS or the FSA. I'm worried about Shakira and Ahmed. My work has positioned me directly between them."
Meyer pursed his lips.
"In what way?"
"It's about the job I'm here to do in Paris. If I do it correctly, and Ahmed finds out, I will be killed when I return to Syria."
Stefan Meyer flashed a glance to the director of operations, a look of annoyance that something so crass as murder would come up in this meeting. Stefan leaned back in his chair now, and Ian leaned forward.
"Perhaps this is something you and I should discuss, and I have protected billions of dollars of assets at Meyer in the past several years, and the bank knew of my, as you call them, legal troubles, the day I was hired. I only asked to be brought in from the cold, taken out of imminent danger, and set up somewhere secure. I will continue to work ceaselessly for the bank, just not in between the President and First Lady of Syria."
The oldest man in the room, Bruno Olvetti, was the vice director of finance. He was there only because he served as the older Meyer brothers' eyes and ears. Bruno came to meetings like this to watch over Stefan and to report back to Rolf. He said,
"This perilous position you speak of, how much of it is your own doing?"
"What do you mean by that?"
"Are you having an affair with Shakira Azam?"
Drexler could not possibly imagine how Bruno could know about that. He thought it possible, likely even, that the old man was just bluffing, assuming a relationship because he knew Drexler worked closely with Shakira on discreet matters.
Shakira was an attractive woman, and Drexler considered himself a very desirable man. He said,
"Nice try, Bruno, but there is no affair."
To his surprise, Stefan Meyer spoke up now.
"You wouldn't be calling our client's word into question, would you?"
Drexler said nothing.
"She told my brother herself that the two of you are involved."
Stefan laughed a little.
"According to Rolf, she genuinely seems fond of you. Well done. You've somehow melted the heart of the First Lady of Hell."
Drexler recovered quickly.
"All the more reason, gentlemen, to pull me out. There has been certain pressure placed on me by the First Lady over the past year or so. It has put me at odds with the President, and..."
Ian Pleasance took off his glasses and rubbed his drooping eyes.
"Oh, come on now, man. Are you here to tell us you are being sexually harassed by your client?"
Stefan and the others chuckled now. The muscles in Sebastian Drexler's neck flexed, but he kept his composure.
"I have told you what I have come to tell you. If I return to Syria, it is likely I will be killed, and it is likely the President will hold my employers, yourselves, that is, responsible for the actions against him and his interests. He does still hold sway over his wife, you know. He could simply coerce her into moving assets from your bank."
Meyer replied,
"Shakira is free to remove her assets at any time, irrespective of what her husband knows, or suspects, or insists upon. Even if we comply with your request, if we simply recall you from Damascus or never send you back there, then what is to keep her from getting angry with us and making other arrangements with her money?"
"That is a fair question. The bank will be safe when I don't return, because Shakira will be convinced that I died here in France. I don't need your help to do that. I just need your help after the fact. Shakira will learn of my demise only after learning of the success of my operation, and she will be indebted to Meyer Privatbank."
"Such subterfuge," Stefan said with a smile. "You certainly have a flair for the dramatic, don't you? Sleeping with the Syrian president's wife, and devising a plan to simulate your own death."
Drexler did not bat an eyelash.
"Herr Meyer, in the employ of your firm, I have killed or ordered the deaths of more than 24 men and women. There is drama here that is not of my doing as well."
Meyer glowered at Drexler, but he made no immediate reply. Pleasance was about to speak, when Drexler held up a hand.
"Gentlemen, I only ask for a way out of this posting. You need someone to do the work I do. Allow me to do it in Hong Kong, in Rio, in the Caymans. Just don't send me back to Damascus."
Stefan Meyer continued his hard stare for several seconds, then nodded slowly. He said,
"All right, Sebastian. You are a key element of the success of our bank. Accomplish your mission in France. Save Shakira's place in the palace. Then, only then, we will get you out of there."
"So I don't have to go back to Damascus,"
Stefan said.
"You don't want to go and wish your lover adieu and bon chance?"
Drexler knew the bankers were toying with him. He was a fascinating character in their boring lives, exactly the man any of these fat, weak men would love to be for just one day. So of course they would mock him, pretend his actions were beneath their station. Drexler said,
"I have no need to see her ever again."
Stefan shrugged.
"Very well. Your plan to fake your death in Paris is approved. We will hide you in Switzerland until such a time as we find a posting for you that is to your liking."
Bruno Olvetti pointed a finger across the table.
"Don't ever forget, Drexler. You may be our best fixer and hatchet man, but Shakira Azam is more important to us than you are.
As long as she is happy, we are happy.
And as long as we are happy, you are safe. If you don't succeed in your mission here, or if you don't pull off your subterfuge with your little trick in faking your death, then we send you back to Syria."
Drexler stood, gave a courteous bow to the bankers, and headed for the door. He was motivated now like he had not been in years. A lifeline had been thrown to him, and all he had to do in order to take it and pull himself to safety Was Kill a fashion model being hidden by a pair of doctors and an over-the-hill ex-French intelligence official? He thought about the American who'd caused him so much trouble, but he told himself Malik and his boys had enough men and guns to handle him.
Tonight he'd link up with Malik, the Mukhabarat assassin sent by Ahmed Azam to help find and rescue Bianca and the bent French police captain, and together they'd get their hands on Bianca Medina.
He'd be threading a very small needle with his operation after that, but when he finally managed to kill Medina, and Shakira was both satisfied with Drexler's work and convinced he'd died in the execution of it, then he'd be able to be rid of Syria once and for all. But first things first. He wasn't leaving Europe, not anytime soon at least. As soon as he climbed into his rental car, he would rip the dead flesh off his fingertips and say goodbye to poor Viti Tikala. Chapter 32. Vincent Volin stood on the parking circle in front of the country estate near the village of La Brosse as the last of the day's light faded. In front of him, just rolling up the driveway by the greenhouse, a black Lincoln Navigator flashed its headlights.
Dr. Tarik Alabi stepped outside through the side door to the property and shouldered up to Voland.
He, too, watched the vehicle approach.
I take it these are the security men you ordered up?
Voland nodded.
The very best. That money can buy,
Tarik added.
We must face the facts. After 7 years of war, many have tired of your cause. The men and women still alive who will fight for you without charge are, in large part, men and women who know little about fighting.
As the navigator rolled to a stop, he added,
The men with the skills to fight this battle do not hold an ideological attachment to your particular fight. Nevertheless, these are men of principle. They will protect this property from anyone who threatens it.
Tarik Alabi's hand reached under his safari jacket and touched something unfamiliar there, and it occurred to him, not for the first time today, that he had never fired a gun in his life. All his time in Syria, surrounded by armed rebels and more than once within shouting distance of regime forces or ISIS terrorists, and he'd never taken to arming himself. He was a doctor, not a soldier. But now he had a Walther P-99 jammed into his corduroy pants, and an extra magazine in the pocket of the safari coat. Vincent Volin had offered the weapon a few hours earlier as they waited for the cavalry to arrive in the form of the four ex-members of the French Foreign Legion, and when Tarik at first demurred, Volin countered that the only thing between Syrian assassins and Bianca Medina were five over-the-hill ex-Syrian soldiers, none of whom had any special forces or advanced combat training. A nephew of his wife who taught high school physics, and a 65-year-old former French spook who'd only used a weapon in anger once in his life, over 35 years earlier in Lebanon. And, Volin had added, he'd missed that target in Lebanon. When this realization sank in, Tarik took the pistol from Volin, along with 5 minutes instruction on how to shoot it and reload it, and a promise from the Frenchman that he wouldn't mention anything about the weapon to Rima Halabi, because Tarik doubted his wife would approve of him carrying a firearm as a matter of safety. Now that the security men were here, Tarik wondered if he should hand the gun back, but only for a moment, and then changed his mind. He didn't know these men any better than he knew this man Sebastian Drexler that Voland kept mentioning with a bizarre combination of revulsion and awe. Tarik would keep an eye on these men just the same as he would anyone else with the potential to put this operation in jeopardy. The SUV doors opened, and four men climbed out. They carried short-barreled submachine guns, already slung on their shoulders, and large packs on their backs. To Tarik, they all appeared to be in their 50s, and two of the four men were quite obviously overweight. They looked nothing like the American contract killer he'd been working with, and Tarik found himself disappointed. Voland spoke softly to Tarik as the men hefted bags out of the rear of the SUV. Clearly, he recognized what Tarik was thinking.
It's been a few years since I've seen them, but they are a team that works together all over the world. They have quite a good reputation. Don't worry, they will handle themselves.
From his comment, Tarik thought Volin seemed worried about the men's appearance himself. Volin stepped forward and met the men in the middle of the parking circle, greeting them with warm and familiar handshakes, and with pats on the back he walked one of the men back over to the Syrian. The Frenchman said,
Dr. Helabi, I present to you Monsieur Paul Boyer.
Tarek shook the hand of a heavy-set man with a trim gray beard and thin combed-over hair. Boyer spoke with a French accent.
I and my men are here at your service, doctor. We'd like to set up by nightfall, so perhaps we can do our formal introductions later.
Bien sûr, Monsieur Boyer.
All four men passed into the house. The three associates of Boyer never even looked up as they walked by Tarek. Helabi turned again to Voland, but the Frenchman spoke before the Syrian doctor could air his concerns.
Boyer is French, a former major in the French Foreign Legion. The others are Campbell from Scotland, Laghari from India, and Novak from Hungary. All legionnaires.
Tarek said,
Four men, Vincent? I hope it's enough.
Voland smiled.
If Drexler finds this house, he'll have backup for sure, but remember, he's working for Shakira, not Ahmed, so he can't use resources from the Syrian government. He'll have some local cops, like the two you met in your apartment, and they'll be cut down before they get within 100 meters of Mademoiselle Medina.
Tarek felt a little better with this reminder. Voland said,
Now, let's see where Boyer positions his men, so we can move your men to provide the best additional coverage.
The men returned to the house to speak with the FSEU security staff. Another night was coming, and despite Voland's confidence, with the darkness came danger. On the far side of the house, Rima Halabi descended the stairs that led to the wine cellar.
She'd taken to checking on Bianca twice a day, spending an hour with her, gently reminding the beautiful model that all was not lost, since the American was surely somewhere right now looking to get himself into Syria.
At the bottom of the stairs, she looked across the length of the large wine cellar and saw Furis, and when she did, she sighed. He had been down here all the previous night and all day long, so when she saw him slumped over the tiny wine table, she did not get angry. As long as the door to Bianca's room was closed and locked, Rima saw no problem with her nephew taking brief naps throughout the day. As she walked across the concrete floor, her footfalls echoed in the room, and she expected Firas to stir. When he did not, she called to him.
I brought a sleeping bag down here yesterday, Firas. Why don't you use it and get some rest?
The young school teacher did not move.
Firas, how is our guest?
The young man did stir now, but he just moved his arm a little on the table, and in doing so, he knocked a wine glass onto the floor, shattering it. Rima was surprised by this, but doubly so when she saw a second glass, half-filled with red wine, on the table. She raced the rest of the way across the small room, and now she saw the two empty bottles on the floor.
Phyllis!
She shouted, and her nephew sat up, ramrod straight, but he was disoriented, confused. Clearly he was drunk. Now she moved to the door to the guest quarters, put her hand on the latch, and tested it. To her dismay, the door opened, and to her horror, the room was empty. She ran through the narrow room to the bathroom. The door was opened, and it was unoccupied. Now she ran back into the wine cellar, over to the storeroom adjacent to Medina's quarters. She threw this door open, hoping against hope she'd see the model in there. But instead, she just saw racks of cleaning solvents, mops, furniture polish, and other housekeeping supplies.
Phyllis!
She shouted again.
Where did she go?
Back in the wine cellar, Firas was standing now on wobbly legs, but he wasn't responsive to his aunt's question. Rima did not have her phone on her, nor did she have a radio. It occurred to her that she wouldn't know the code to use Firas's iPhone, and this was something they should have organized before an emergency. She ran over to her nephew, opened up his jacket, and checked to see if his gun was still there. To her relief, Bianca had not disarmed him. Rima yanked the weapon from his pants, spun away, and raced up the wooden steps as fast as she could. She didn't know if the gun had a safety on it, though it hardly mattered, because she wasn't going to shoot Bianca. It was a tool for bluffing, but she knew it would only work for that if she found her prisoner. Bianca Medina opened the door from the hearth room that led out to the stone patio at the back of the home. Beyond the manicured lawn, a forest of hard woods looked dark and foreboding now, as dusk set in. but she knew she had a much better chance of disappearing out there in the dark, so she fought against her fear and steeled herself to make a run for it. She had grown more and more worried with each passing hour that Ahmed would simply kill Jamal back in Damascus, even if the American did his best to